This is The Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome to The Business of Wealth. Today we are with Martin Hall, who's the founder of 10 Capital and host of Investor Connect. Welcome, Martin.
Thanks for having me, Alejandro. Looking forward to it.
Yes. So today we're going to talk a lot about investing in startups. But first of all, I want to hear a little bit more about yourself. And instead of just telling me your whole, you know, historic biography, I want you to tell me what's the best compliment you ever received.
I think the best compliment I ever received is you have the strongest brand of anybody I know. I didn't expect that, but they were doing research and talked around and found I had a very, very strong brand in my network. So always appreciated that. Been curating it for 20 years. So I guess something went well in that process.
So how did you end up in the VC startup community and, you know, in here?
Sure. So I worked for a high-tech company for about 20 years and they went IPO along the way. And so I started doing angel investing and I started getting involved in that here in Austin. We had a group in the 90s I was a part of for a while, made an investment through there, lost all my money and started to learn that it's harder than it looks. And then that group went away. And then when they did a restart of the angel group in Austin, I was the first member to sign up for it. And so I was actually on the board in charge of membership, became the director and led it for the first 2 years. And we got a 40X return for the investors out of it. So it propelled the group on. And then it helped start other groups like the Baylor Angel Network and the Wilco Angel Network. And then, so that's how I got into it, was through the angel process, and then started my company under the name Texas Entrepreneurs Network in 2009. Because I saw the challenge startups had in raising funding and I saw the challenge investors had in finding successful companies. So we formed the company to help solve that problem. And we carried that company on until about 2017, at which point we were getting calls from outside of Texas wanting access to our investor network. So we rebranded to 10 Capital, that's what 10 stands for, and started working across the U.S. And so it's been a 12-year journey, and it's what I've wanted to do as a second career. I'm a startup guy, an early phase guy. I love the early phase. And so that's what I wanted to do, was leave the big corporate world and get back to the early phase. And today, just about everything is early phase. So it's a good time for us.
Yeah. And what is one question that you wish you were asked more often, either from startups or from investors?
I think the question most people miss when they come to me is, aside from raising funding, how else can I fund my startup? And there's many ways to do that. You can go out and get contracts and consultation gigs and form in another way to build a business till you get to the point where you can actually launch, you know, scalable platform-based businesses, which we want to see in the venture world. And I think some people just want to go raise money from family and friends to build a multi-billion dollar business, but, you know, you run out of money before you get there. Surprise, surprise. And so you have to find other ways to do it. And I think the best way of funding is what I call customer funding. You get a customer to pay for it. You learn a lot when you do that. You learn what they'll pay for, what they value, what exactly they want. They're not paying for what they don't want. They're paying for what they do want. And so it becomes much more real in the conversation when you do that. And there's different ways of achieving that. It does take work. Some people just want money to go work on something. But if you get out and engage with customers, you get more than just money. You get experience, you get products, you get happy customers, you get so many more things out of it. So I wish people would spend more time working with a customer on helping find funding for their business in addition to investors. Sometimes you do have to go to investors to raise some money. And that's what they're there for.
But you mentioned something interesting. You said you want to build a scalable platform-based business. What do you mean by that?
So in the venture world, what investors look for, and I get this question a lot, is they really want a platform-based business, because if you do that, as opposed to a consultation or a one-off product business, platform-based business gives you scalability. You can scale that up very large. And so you built in from the beginning the ability to scale your company. You start off as a consultant or a contractor or a one-off product. You will go a certain ways, but then scaling will be a challenge and you'll have to move to platform-based businesses to get there. And venture, you know, from the day one, they're looking for that. Many angels are looking for that. And so if you want to raise funding, make sure you have a path that gets you to a platform-based business, because you'll find it's lower cost, it's scalable, it's easier to manage, and there's many, many benefits that come with it. Some call it just recurring revenue-based businesses, but in addition to the monetization, it's also how you architecture the onboarding, the support, et cetera. And so, but it's the type of business investors want. And I think startups need to take that into account. I meet many startups that say, well, I had a vision for my business. Okay, well, that's your vision, but how does that align with the investor's vision? And if it does, you'll raise funding. If it doesn't, it'll be hard. And that's one reason why many people don't raise funding, is they're not aligning with the investor's vision.
Okay. So you were mentioning, like, in wealth management, there's a lot of businesses that act as consultants, basically. How would you, you know, how do you advise them to convert into a platform? What's the path that you recommend? How, any methods, any methodologies?
So my recommendation for someone that wants to build a platform-based business is go find three customers who want maybe a customized version of what you want. They'll pay a turnkey custom software price for it. These are several hundred thousand dollars. And then when you build a solution, you're licensing it to them. You're not just giving them everything, but you're building it on a standard platform, architecture, language, structure, and so forth. And all three projects need to be built under the same mode, where you get to reuse the different modules, the display, the storage, the algorithms, and so forth. So you're building it in a very standardized format. And by the end of your third customer, out comes what I would call a standard platform that you can now sell as a standard solution to other companies. Up front, you look for companies that need to have it now, or they want something very custom, and they're willing to pay for it. These are typically larger customers. They're not smaller customers. But that's a great way, because they're going to give you specifications. They're going to tell you what works. They're going to show you what the competition is like. They're going to show you the value prop it brings. And so you get a tremendous amount out of it. Some call those anchor clients or anchor customers. But like I say, I've worked with many, many startups, and I've noticed that many of the larger, you know, recurring revenues, you know, SaaS-based businesses have come out of the digital media world, where there was a group of people, we were solving a problem, we couldn't find a solution for a problem, so we created our own. Now other people are asking for it. And so that's one way to get into it, is to do some non-scalable things up front. But what you'll find is you're basically having your customer fund your business rather than outside investors. The beauty of that is customers are non-dilutive. They're not on the cap table. They're also helping you with the business and figuring out what the platform should be. And you have to stay on target or on task. You can't just chase any custom project that comes through. If you do, you'll find that that's very hard to align all the elements afterwards. So it's got to be upfront. You design what you figure out what you want to build, and then you're looking for customers that want some version of that, and you build it for them.
It's just that generally you have financial advisors or wealth managers. They have their own methodology beyond technology, right? Or consultants, you have your own methodology, and converting that into a technology platform, which is what I understand you're saying, through a client, sometimes gets really cumbersome, and it's a long process. I've lived it through many clients, right? The productization of a consulting business is not easy, right?
That's right. So you're looking at a group of customers, in this case, maybe financial advisors, and you see the work that has to be done. They have to take in certain investment vehicles. They have to analyze them. They have to take in clients. They have to look at their requirements and goals, and then you're matching them together. And so you're going through and figuring out what would be a platform-based business. So all of the customers are logging into the same system. They're getting access to the same modules. So it just goes to how you structure it. And then you go to the three or four big groups and say, well, I'll build you a custom version for what you need. And then you go build it in a standardized manner. And then they're telling you, well, I need this data set or that data set. the customer needs to have this formatted output report. We need to store the data in this format. And so you get a lot of advice and guidance on what is industry standard when you do that. The key, and then you, the customer is getting a maybe a little bit more of a custom version that comes out. And then what you come out with at the end is what you would call the standard platform that you can then reuse for anybody or any group.
So number one, I see you say a scalable platform-based business, then find other type of funding. Those are two recommendations you give investors, I'm sorry, startups. What recommendations do you give investors when they are starting out to invest in startups?
My advice for anybody that wants to invest in a startup and is, you want to look at the product and the market and those things at a high level, but where you really want to spend your time is with the team. Go out and meet the team, fly out there, drive out there, and meet everybody on the team and do a skills assessment. What do they know? What do they not know? And then as you look at the startup challenge that they have, you're estimating what skills are needed to make this business successful. You're always asking what assumptions need to be true and what do we have to do to win this business or to make this successful as we're proposing it to be, and boil that down to skills, how much industry knowledge, how much financial, how much sales, how much marketing, what exactly needs to be known and what exactly do they need to do, and map that to the team that they have or the team that they are proposing to bring on board. And then look at it from that point. Most investors look at the product, they look at the competition, they look at the market, but they don't usually dig in deep enough on the team. Yes, they look at the CEO, but who else is back there and what do they really know? And at heart, a team is somebody building it and somebody selling it. And so you're looking for sufficiency on both sides of that equation as well.
So what mistakes did you make? You mentioned, you know, it was harder than you thought when you started out. What mistakes did you make and what did you learn?
Well, I told a group of investors once what I did, and I made about 25 mistakes, and the audience said, no, you made about 50 mistakes. And so I think I made every mistake in the book. I did not go out and meet the team. And that was one of the biggest surprises when the business went under. I finally asked them one day, and actually they made many mistakes along the way. And at one point I asked, now, do you have a board? And they said, yeah, I have a board. Well, who's on it? Well, my mom and my dad and my brother. I said, that's not a board. That's a Christmas card. And so I had no idea that they didn't have a real board. Again, my mistake. I should have asked that question. It was a family business. It was brothers, you know, running the business and so forth. And the challenge with that is, you know, family businesses, you know, have their pluses and minuses. And one of the minuses is that in many cases, they don't keep each other accountable for results, and you can't fire your brother. So if they don't get there, you're usually a lesser business. And this certainly was one case like that as well. And then they just had too many goofs along the way where they just weren't thinking clearly. They did have a product. They did have a good market. They did have a potential exit. But the question we didn't ask is, did they have the skills? And the answer is no. And what was required? Well, you have to build a business to achieve the exit, hire your employees instead of making them contractors, having your own facility. And what was the path to getting there? And in retrospect, that was a much steeper hill to climb than we ever thought. I did not do the diligence to figure that out.
And so what is it that, you know, what's the one factor that you look into a startup that you think will make it succeed, you know, team? And then what else? How do you really know it will succeed? You know, what is it? Yes, skills is one thing, but I think that the emotional grit it takes to build a startup is also key. How do you evaluate that?
One of the core things I look for is, how well do they know their customer? And the ones I found that succeed are the ones that know the customer very, very well. And I've seen companies succeed even though they got the product wrong, they got the price wrong, they got the packaging wrong. They got the go-to-market wrong, but they understood the customer problem and the customer very well. And they were able to modify and pivot to a successful version of that. Those who don't know the customer very well, I find they struggle to pivot towards that. They're chasing this, they're chasing that. But knowing the customer very, very well, how much they'll pay, how they want it packaged, what exactly is the problem they're trying to solve, how many people have that problem. Those are the things that I think really drive the success at the end that I look for, because many of these other things, you know, can be fixed. The product can be changed. You know, the marketing message and positioning can be changed, but the customer, you know, we need to know who they are, because while they may change over time, it's usually fixed right now what the issue is. And so how well do we really know that? So those who have actually worked in the space are head and shoulders above those who are new to the space. In emerging technologies, there's just a lot of new people coming into those areas.
And you mentioned something interesting just now when you were talking about the business that went under, and you mentioned a factor of employees versus contractors. Why do you take that as a factor? Why is it important? With the gig economy, you have a ton of companies building out their business based on contractors, and some of them work. Well, Uber worked, right? So what's that factor that you had into account that you just mentioned?
Well, you're looking for skills that are in the business. Who has the domain knowledge? Who has the knowledge, the technical knowledge to build a product? And you're looking for, do we have that all put together? And so that's what we're looking for. Whether they're a full-time employee or a part-time contractor, that skill needs to be attached to the business. And that's the beauty of the gig economy, is it's not hard to go fill in gaps. We can go hire a 20-hour person, a 20-hour week person to go fill a gap for us. And that's very easily brought on board. We don't have to do a full hire, or pay the full salary or what have you. The key is to know that you need that skill and integrate it in and make sure that's part of the solution that you're putting together. That's the thing we look for. And like I say, many people come in with a nice, beautiful slide on their pitch deck about who's going to be on the team. But in most cases, what I found is if, you know, the person that puts up, you know, we got six great rock star people, they're really not on board right now. We're going to bring them on board. And to a certain extent, that's true. You know, you have to bring them on when you have revenue to pay them and you have a place for them to work and, you know, they have resources to do something. And so oftentimes those are visionary slides. That's why I say, well, let's go see who is on the team now and what is it going to take to get to that beautiful slide where we have six full-time hires up there. Usually that means $1 million of revenue or more. And so what's going to take to get from here to there? And so go-to-market strategies become very important. And that's one thing investors should look at is, okay, what's the first product? What's the beachhead market? Who are the first 20 customers we're going to go to? How are we doing with those 20 customers? Because in the first 6 to 12 months, it's really going to be that's really going to be the discussion you have with a startup, is how we're doing on those 20 customers. And that's a focused discussion. Oftentimes people want to talk about how things are doing in general, but I like to get down to, well, what exactly are we winning and achieving today with customers? And when you get to 20 logos, you know, the conversation starts to get a little bit more focused in that case.
Let's go into those KPIs. You know, what are the key KPIs you look at when analyzing a company?
So number one is your growth rate. You know, in the venture world, you're doubling revenue year over year. So like I say, I have companies coming in with 20% year over year growth rate, and they claim we're on the venture track. Well, I found anything below 50% year over year growth rate is going to be hard. COVID had a great reshuffling of it. And in truth be known, investors really only care what happens coming out of COVID, because we're now into a different market and a different world. But they are looking for, you know, basically doubling year over year revenue. So that's number one. Number two is you have a cost customer acquisition and lifetime value, even if it's not pure SaaS, there's some repeat customers going on, and there's some ability to acquire customers, and you know what that is. It's what I call the repeatable, predictable model. Investors don't care how big your revenue is. What they care about is how predictable it is. And if you're building a predictability machine, that's what gets investors excited, because we've built in standard processes for finding customers, signing them up, and keeping them on the using the product for a period of time. And when we know what those numbers are. And so those are two key metrics that we look at.
That's great. Yeah, we talk about customer journeys all the time here and, well, in our business. And the customer retention for me is even more important than the lead generation. Everybody focuses on lead generation, but the customer retention, you know, talks much more to the, you know, the long time value of a company. Okay, so I'm going to give you just a couple questions to finish up a little later. Tell me something that's true that almost nobody agrees with you on.
I think what people disagree with me on is I think you can engage customers even without a product. And my coaching is, you never go to an investor without having some discussion or engagement with the customer. And most people say, well, no, I have to have a product first and they have to be interested and then I'll have a customer. And I say, well, no, before you even build a product, you should be out talking to the customer about what they want to see, what their issue is. I went to IBM, they have this problem. And you go tell that to the investor. Investors love that because it shows you are connected with the marketplace. The 95% that come to you saying, I've got this product, but I've not talked to a customer, the investor's worried because you're not connected to the marketplace. You're building something that you think is cool, but there's no market reality in there yet. And at some point, you'll have to put it in. I hope it's not on my dime is what they're thinking. But the idea is you go to customers and figure out what their problems are and then what might be a potential solution they'd like to see. And then you propose your technology, and then you talk about how it might be implemented. And along the way, you get to the point where they're going to give you $50,000 to do a pilot project. And you're telling that to the investor all along the way. And like I say, most people, when I talk to, well, who's the customer and what are they saying? You know, they say, well, we haven't talked to customers or we can't go to them until we have a product. And so people universally disagree with me on that. Mm-hmm. Where I think you should go to the customer before you build a product, not after you build it, because now we're going to be pivoting and retrofitting and reworking to get back to where the customer is. So you should figure that out up front in most cases.
And you know, you built a great network. I'm sure you see hundreds of startups go through your inbox every month. Do you have any that you actually passed on and you say, oh my God, why did I pass on that one?
Oh, I think there's many, many opportunities that come through that I wish we had gotten involved with. Could have gotten in on some blockchain companies back when they were, you know, pennies on the dollar. Of course, there were hundreds that did not make it. So that would have been lost funding there as well. So I don't beat myself up too much, because in the early stage emerging world, there's just a tremendous fallout rate or dropout rate. So you really don't know where the winners are going to be. You have to do a portfolio approach where you invest in 10 or more companies and one or two will succeed out of that is how most people approach it. So it's just part of the way it works itself. But it's sometimes amazing to see what comes back and that actually worked. I would not have guessed that. And sometimes I've seen that over the years from time to time as well. It's not often, but it does happen.
So we have a ton, I've met a ton of financial advisors that say the same thing, actually. You know, it's about the portfolio, not about stock picking. It's sort of the same thing in this case, I suppose.
That's right. It's like you see a lot of investors now taking an index fund approach to startups, where instead of coming in with two or three 50K checks, they're going to come in with about 10 to 20 5K checks. And they're just going to pass 5K around everybody. And then when one or two start to really, you know, pop up and grow, well, then we're going to double down at that point on those. So you see a lot more of that direction going on, where it's just so hard to tell where it's going to be. We'll just put a, you know, spread the bets around and then see what grows from it.
Right. Okay. How can anybody like actually participate in your network? I know you basically connect investors with startups. How, what's the process like?
Sure. So on our website, 10capital.group, there's an investor page. You can sign up there. There's no cost to join as an investor. For many of our deals, you have to be accredited, but we are moving into crowdfunding. So there's opportunities for those who are not accredited to join as well. So looking forward to connecting with anybody that would like to be an investor in an early stage company. We do have investor info sessions and other events. We do 15 events a month. They're all online, half hour, hour long webinars, Zoom calls, pitch sessions, et cetera, where you can engage with the startups, you can learn how to invest in startups, and you can get feedback on what you're trying to do with your business or with your startup investing portfolio. And we also help angel groups. We help them find members. That's something that they all need help with. And we have a large network. We can reach out to say, well, who would like to be a formal member of that group? And so that works also.
That's great. Martin, it has been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.